Yum, yum food. Glorious, nutritious, and delicious food produced in Canada. Over the next 12 months, I will be dedicating one episode a month to food. Food production, food science, food nutrition, and food in the environment. I'm calling the series Food for Thought. In his book, Food 5.0, agrologist and international consultant Robert Syke points out that less than 0.2% of the population of this country are farmers of consequence. That's just enough people to fill the stands at a professional hockey arena. And thankfully, it's enough skilled people to feed Canada and millions, if not billions, of other people around the world. The production of food is extremely complex. Seed varieties change to meet soil and weather conditions on a county-by-county basis. Tractors use laser-guided GPS systems to line up row after row of seeds. Tilling the soils in the vast prairies of North America is an out-of-date practice, yet tilling the soils in the wetlands of coastal BC may or may not be required, depending on soil conditions. There is no one size that fits all in agriculture. To grow food, you need four elements: fertile soil, sun, water, and carbon. These are the building blocks of photosynthesis, a combination that has to be just right. Getting it right is not easy. Rain, snow, hail, wind, individually and collectively at times make farming an art that relies on science and technology to get it right. Syke says the next 30 years are arguably the most challenging years in agriculture's history. As the population around the world grows from 7.6 to 9.5 billion people, the question is, will we be allowed to feed them? Not can we, but will we be allowed to feed them? Syke contends that agricultural policies that are developed by voters who've never set foot on a farm, mixed in with a heavy application of the precautionary principle, will ensure that we cannot feed the people of the world. I invited Robert Syke, author of Food 5.0 and an ag industry thought leader, to join me for a conversation that matters about the remarkable world of farming in Canada.
Conversations That Matter is a partner program of the Centre for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the following and viewers like you. Please become a patron at conversationsthatmatter.tv.
Robert, thanks for joining me. You're in central Alberta in farm country. Even though you've got a few trees behind you, I know you've got some fields.
Yeah, they're seeding right over there, yeah.
Your entire life has been agriculture.
Yep.
Mine hasn't. I sit here in Vancouver, having grown up in an urban environment with very little relationship with the production of food. So I recently started to research food and quickly learned that it's incredibly complex, and it would be absolutely, well, pure folly on my behalf to try and say, like Michael Bloomberg did, I understand what it takes to grow food. I turned to you because your book, Food 5.0, opened my eyes to what is required to grow food on farms of consequence. How complex is the production of food?
Food production is extremely complex because every ecosystem in the world requires a different set of management skill to deal with the production of food in the face of biotic and abiotic stress. Canada in particular is noted for being very, very inventive when it comes to agricultural innovation. People say we think outside the box. It's not true. What we have in Western Canada is a very, very small box. We have to get the crop in the ground in 30 days. We have to grow it in 100 to 110 days, and we have to get the crop off in 40 days. My neighbor didn't get his crop off last year, so he's had to seed it. It's just about June now, so he had to harvest it this spring and seed it this spring. So the constraints of farming and the constraints of agriculture are different everywhere in the world. And so when we hear on social media about people having these simplistic solutions to solve agriculture or food, it's nonsense. agriculture is extremely nuanced, extremely complex, and I would argue the most complex business in the world, because you've got abiotic, wind, hail, frost, snow, drought, and then you've got biotic stresses, which are diseases, insects, weed control, all those things all coming together, most of which a farmer doesn't control.
No, they have very little control over it. Despite that, we've done a really good job of trying to put as many tools in the hands of farmers to be able to produce an abundance of food.
We have an abundance of food, and we owe that abundance to science and the integration of science and agriculture. It's no mistake that we live in the most abundant, safest, healthiest time in human history, and I would argue that's because of science and agriculture, in particular agricultural science integration together.
I've heard you quote Norman Borlaug before and the Green Revolution and the contribution that he made to the lives of more than a billion people, and yet it seems as though we need that same kind of advancement now if we're hoping to feed a world in excess of 9 billion people. Do you think we're going to be able to do that? And I pose the question, or put it that way, about being able to, because are we going to be allowed to do it? I know we can do it, but will we be allowed to do it?
Yeah, the real question is, I mean, I would argue that the next 30 years between 2020 and 2050 are arguably the most challenging years in agriculture's history. Now, as the population goes from 7.6 to 9.5 billion people on the planet, I'm totally confident that we can feed them. The question you put is, will we be allowed to? We've done this before. Norman Borlaug and people like that who brought technology allowed us to increase agricultural production in the face of an increasing population from 1960 until now. But that was with agriculture adopting and embracing technologies. Today, we have a society that's largely divorced. Most people watching this show right now have never set foot on a farm and would really not understand the complexities of science integration. So the question is, when you have policy that's dictated by voters who don't understand the implications of that policy. In other words, if you make all your rules by the precautionary principle, which says that you can't have any technology until you can prove it's safe, which is nonsense because in science that's a double negative, you can never prove something safe, then you have no adoption of new technology. Between now and 2050, we've got to grow 10,000 years worth of food in the next 30 years. We have to increase food production everywhere on the planet, 60 to 70% everywhere on the planet, which puts even more pressure on exporting nations like Canada and Australia. So we have got to be able to embrace science. And for a society that largely has a predicated notion that agriculture is round-fendered pickup trucks and little red barns and farmers with bib overalls on, it's preposterous to think that we can increase production to feed a 2050 population with antiquated agricultural practices. That dog don't hunt.
There's a professor at Oxford University who is paid just to think. His name is Nicholas Bostrom. And he came up with a theory called Maxipoc. Bostrom says it is very dangerous existentially to guard against risk completely.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if we take the climate change as something that agriculture has to deal with, how do we in agriculture deal with climate change? How do we make crops more drought resistant? How do we reduce the utilization of fertilizer by creating crops that can fix their own nitrogen? How do we make crops more saline tolerant? You know, if you talk about that, there's going to be a cure that'll come on the scene for COVID. It'll be a vaccination. Very likely that'll be a genetically engineered vaccination. Can you tell me that the next vaccination that somebody takes doesn't have some side effects? Well, there's a precautionary principle. So don't take it until you can prove to me that it's absolutely safe. Well, it's nonsense. It's always about risk-benefit. Everything that we do in life is risk-benefit. You get in that car, there's a benefit. There's a huge risk that you could get killed. So stop driving, stop flying. Stop, you know, water is a hazard. It can kill you. You can drown in water, but try to say to some people that they can't have water anymore. It's a nonsense argument.
You talked about a food producer as somebody who takes sunlight and converts it into food. But they're also converting CO2 into food. And it plays a huge role whether or not you're planting crops
right.
or whether you're raising animals. What is the environmental footprint of farming?
Well, the environment, and there's nothing natural about agriculture. So let's just start off by saying that people say, want to get back to nature. Well, then you're going to be naked, hungry, foraging for something. But there's nothing natural about agriculture. Agriculture is a manipulation of the environment to produce food, harnessing sunlight energy. You know, we hear a lot of negative stuff right now that we shouldn't eat meat. Livestock, the cattle are killing the planet. They're causing global warming. Well, let me ask you a question. Cows eat grass or corn or barley, and that is a crop that grew through the photosynthetic process. So it ingested carbon dioxide to make grass. The cow ate the grass, and the cow burps out methane. Now, methane has a half-life of 10 years. Carbon dioxide has a half-life of 1,000 years in the atmosphere, and nitrous oxide has a half-life of 100 years. So we take methane, the cow eats the carbon dioxide in the form of cellulose or hemicellulose. It burps it out as methane, and in 10 years, the methane turns back to carbon. So explain to me where the cow's made greenhouse gases from. Because they ate the grass that sequestered the carbon dioxide that was in the air in the first place. They burp out methane, and the half-life of methane is 10 years versus 1,000 years of carbon dioxide. And that carbon dioxide now is converted back from the methane back in the atmosphere. Explain to me how they're increasing greenhouse gases, because they're not. Nobody talks about the fact that there was 100 million ruminants running around North America before Columbus ever set foot here. We've got about 100 million today. Nobody talks about the fact that the livestock herd in North America plateaued at its peak in 1970 and has been leveling off or going down ever since, and yet we get more production with fewer animals. And yet Hollywood says that livestock is killing the planet. No, it's not. It's a cycle. It's a cycle that most people don't understand. And so the only way you could increase the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere through the livestock herd is if you increase the livestock herd. But the livestock herd isn't going up. It's actually going down. So none of this washes. And so again, consumers are being fed a whole bunch of misinformation by media, largely spinning activist sentiments.
I recently interviewed Quick Dick McDick.
Hey, Quick Dick McDick!
He pointed out, he says, I get some guy or woman living in a concrete environment talking to me as though I don't know what I'm doing. So, to your point about activists, this becomes challenging when somebody starts to enter into your area of expertise and telling you how you should do it. People like Michael Bloomberg, for example. And he is a part of a growing group of people who are influencing politicians and, by extension, policy.
Well, this goes back to, again, the understanding of basic science. So if I say something's got 10 parts per million in it, or it's got 100 parts per billion in it, which is more dangerous? Well, a part per million is 1 second in 11 and a half days. That's a part per million. A part per billion is 1 second in 32 years. So if you have something that has 100 parts per billion, is that more dangerous for you than something with 10 parts per million? Well, I'll just ask the audience, you go do the math on that. And yet I can make 100 parts per billion sound really, really scary, and it's inconsequential. And now we have diagnostic equipment that can test in parts per trillion. What the hell does that mean? So it means nothing. But again, activists can spin this out. Just because we can test for something doesn't mean it's toxic or non-toxic. Like I said earlier, water is toxic if you ingest enough of it. It'll kill you. Everything is poison is made by the dose. Dose makes the poison. So again, do consumers even understand what the hell they're talking about? Are we better off with a pop can per acre, pop can per football field of glyphosate to control weeds? Are we better off tilling that land 4 or 5 times through the growing season to try to control weeds? Are we better off to eliminate glyphosate and replace it by 5 or 6 other cans of material? Nobody thinks about total load. Nobody thinks about total toxicology. Nobody thinks about ramifications of excess tillage and what that does to soil degradation and eventually greenhouse gases. They don't put it together. Why? Because it's complicated. It's way easier to say Roundup is bad.
Another question that I have is about genetically modified organisms or foods. I think of it as genetic engineering. And I have to ask the question, are there any plants that aren't genetically modified?
Well, if I asked you if a plant or a new crop was derived in a laboratory through exposure to nuclear radiation or exposure to carcinogenic chemicals to induce mutation, would you think that's natural?
No.
No, you don't think that's natural. Okay. Well, that process is endorsed by the Organic Association as a form of breeding called mutagenesis. And 3,200 crops, many organic crops, owe their origins to nuclear radiation or carcinogenic chemical mutation. Genetic engineering is an advancement. We've gone from binary code to genetic code. So today, we can go in there, we can sequence out the genome of an apple, and we can shut off enzymes in that apple that would reduce the dehydrogenase enzyme, would reduce oxidization or browning of the apple. You didn't introduce anything, you just flicked off some enzymes to slow down the browning, oxidization. Is that bad or good? Well, you're not introducing anything, it's genetically engineered. You know, if you're thinking about traveling down the road, are you safer on a modified bridge or an engineered bridge? You're safer on an engineered bridge, for God's sakes. So people are all freaked out, but it's an advancement of science. And you can guarantee that the vaccine for COVID will owe its origins to genetic engineering. So we should disband that because that's GMO. Well, you're not going to do that. It has the potential to save potentially millions, if not billions, of people on the planet. The same thing as we face a changing climate, the same as we face the pressure of an increasing population. These are tools that are absolutely necessary for human flourishing. You can't have agriculture advance on a finite footprint of land producing more food, healthier food, more dense food for human flourishing and not give us the tools to do so. So genetic engineering and GMO is the most studied food in world history and is absolutely 100% safe.
One of the things I'm trying to understand about is seed production. If I'm growing canola, for instance, in Western Alberta, am I going to use a different variation of the same seed if I'm in, let's say, Eastern Ontario?
Your seed selection for canola won't vary by Western Canada and Ontario. It'll vary by county. It'll vary much tighter than that. The seeds we use in Central Alberta will be different than the seeds in Southern Saskatchewan. And that's because we have microclimates. And the seeds that we use today in corn production in particular, but also in canola, are hybrid seeds. So a hybrid is a combination to get the best of both traits. So a mule is a very valued animal, and a mule is a combination between a female horse and a male donkey. That's what makes a mule. A mule is a hybrid. Now, the mules can't breed. That's the nature of hybridization. The mules can't breed. The same thing is said of hybridization in our crops. So those seed varieties will change based on ecosystem. They'll change based on growing degree days and season length. And very often farmers will buy new seeds every year. That's not to say all seeds have to be rebought every year, but hybrids do, because they make no sense to replant. You lose all the hybrid vigor. Crops like wheat and barley that are open pollinated, soybeans, can be saved and regrown, but often we don't, because the progenies of those seeds actually diminish in terms of vigor. So there's a reason that the seed industry does, and people who say that farmers are forced to buy their seeds every year, well, that's nonsense. They obviously don't understand hybridization.
In reading a recent survey that was conducted by the Canadian Centre for Food Integrity, they said that upwards of two-thirds of Canadians have concerns about the quality of their food and food security. Are those concerns misplaced from your perspective?
Their concerns are misplaced. We've got regulatory bodies. What's going on today is really a backlash, largely through social media and media, creating suspicion around government agencies, CFIA Canada or PMRA. Try to get a product registered in Canada. Canada is one of the toughest jurisdictions in the world to get products registered. There is a series of tests that have to be done and hoops that have to be gone through before you get a product registered. Our food that comes off of our fields has something called minimum residue levels, MRLs. Those MRLs in the food are tested. Farmers are coached all the time. Make sure that we're using products that are in line with the exporting nation MRL so we don't damage our reputation, to make sure that the food supply is safe. I hear all the time about the hormones in pork and chickens and cattle and dairy and everything. Well, there is no hormones. It's illegal to use hormones in pork and chicken. Cattle, in feedlot cattle, we have some hormones in ear plants that we use to increase feed efficiency and reduce days on feed. But by the time you get that product to a beef patty, the difference is 1 nanogram between something that's been treated with a ear tag and something that's, it's nonsense. So people spin this thing out. And if you look at where the genesis comes from most of the fear mongering, it's backed by big money. Somebody is trying to create fear in the consumer so the consumer would not buy conventional safe food, but would rather pay a whole bunch more money for some adjective or some label.
From your perspective, Canadian food is safe?
Canadian food is exceptionally safe.
So much so that countries around the world want to buy our food.
All over the one thing we're missing in this country is we're doing a lousy job of branding Canada. We are living in a safe, beautiful environment. Canada is known for being clean and green, technologically advanced. Farming is some of the best in the world. How come we're not branding that and selling that all over the planet?
Thank you. I appreciate the glimpses into the world of agriculture that you've provided.
You're welcome.